Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another Zero Point radio broadcast through BBS Radio. It is Saturday, October the 1st, and I'm coming to you from Ottawa, Ontario area. I actually live south of Ottawa, and I've had this show through BBS now for approximately 5 years, and I'm going to bring on my regular co-host, James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris? How's it going?
Okay, good. So I thought we might explore a few areas today, Jim. I wanted to open with a bit of a discourse and give a summary, a little bit of what I try to teach. And then we were going to pick up on looking at Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, and have some readings and explanations of Beelzebub's tales. So I think it should be an interesting show. Okay, so I'm a PhD clinical psychologist and worked in the university setting for 12 years and then in the correctional system in Ontario as a psychologist for 12 years. And the last 12 years, I've worked independently under the logo of Zero Point, which is an institute for the mystical, for mystical and spiritual science. And I'm interested in the synthesis of mystical and scientific viewpoints, and my work brings these into relationship in two main areas of human inquiry, and those concern, firstly, the issue of the nature of human consciousness. And related to that issue is the question of the existence of the human spirit and soul and what these things might actually be. So the first is the issues of psychology and consciousness. And the second area we regularly explore is creation physics and metaphysics. There's certain ideas which have emerged in modern theory, physics, and quantum theory that so parallel and substantiate mystical viewpoints about concerning various metaphysical processes. So we kind of explore the areas of consciousness and creation studies. In a way, there are profound esoteric teachings in mystical sources which explain various cosmic laws according to a mystical perspective. So we try to kind of discuss those laws and try to relate them to science and creation studies. As a psychology student, I became interested in the teachings of G.I. Gurdjieff, a famous and somewhat infamous Russian mystic who lived from about 1877 to 1950 and lived mainly in France during his later life and traveled widely in the Near East during his youth. And Gurdjieff had a system of teaching he called the Fourth Way, which he said might be considered as a form of esoteric Christianity. But then he explained, but not the kind of Christianity we're familiar with. He says Christianity itself originated in early Egyptian times and has this ancient history that we're not aware of. And many of the Christian doctrines and rituals are borrowed from earlier times. So Gurdjieff explained that his teaching, he claimed it was this kind of esoteric teaching which had derived ultimately from Egyptian times but passed through Egypt, but what he says that it was unknown until modern times, so it kind of passed from history. So I began as a graduate student to study the teachings of Gurdjieff and found that they were very practical as a psychology, and they gave a much broader understanding of a human being than what I was learning from my studies in Western psychology. And at the time, I taught theories of personality and abnormal psychology and counseling psychology. So I could see the Gurdjieff teaching was much deeper and addressed more essential questions that were ignored in modern psychology. One thing I realized is how dualistic psychology is, and that when the scientists of new formation, and that's an expression Gurdjieff uses, the scientists of new formation, it's like a newly fangled science. The scientists of new formation always formulate issues and problems in the dualistic way, as though there's only ever two aspects to something. So psychology itself was defined as a behavior of the mind and behavior. At least this has been the predominant viewpoint in the last century. So man has a mind, a mind or a brain and a body, and there's these kind of two aspects to human beings. And instead, Gurdjieff explained that really man needs to be considered as a three-brained being, because he really functions mentally, emotionally, and physically. So it's not just the mind and the physical, but there's also the emotional life. And the emotional life of man is tied to the soul life. Because we talk of the heart and soul, and emotions are related to your soul life. So psychology became a dualistic psychology of the body and the mind, but they lost any psychology of the heart and soul. And this is very significant. When it came to understanding what consciousness is in the human being, scientists assumed that consciousness was being produced by the brain and that it was centered in the head and that it couldn't exist apart from the physical body. So death had to be the end of life because we're only material beings, and when the brain's not working and the heart stops, then you're dead. And that's the end. There is no I. There is nothing in the human being that could survive physical death and persist in other dimensions. And that's been the dogma of modern psychology and philosophy and science for the past century. But in any area of inquiry, if you look at modern psychology and other sciences, you see how much everybody thinks dualistically, that there's the left brain and the right brain. And there's the head and the heart, or there's science and religion, and there's science and pseudoscience. In any area of inquiry, the formatory scientist or scientist of new formation always pose issues dualistically. So there's the conscious and the unconscious. And think of things in the dualistic way. In contrast, when I began studying the Gurdjieff work, he explained that there were two fundamental cosmic laws, the law of three and the law of seven. And at the time, as a psychology student, I thought, what a bizarre notion that there was some kind of cosmic law in the kind of law of a number. Like, how could the law of three be a something or the law of seven? And I've studied this like for 30 to 40 years now, trying to understand the application of the laws of three and seven to my studies of science and compare how that type of thinking compares with other perspectives and teachings and theories in science. Nicole, a commentator, a psychologist who studied the Gurdjieff teaching, gave a succinct summary of esoteric principles when he stated that God is first one, then three, and then seven. So one, three, seven. And in mystical teachings, light is supposed to some form of supernal light is regarded as the kind of an ultimate principle. And if we divide light by a three-sided prism, it gives a spectrum of seven colors. Similarly, mystical and spiritual teachings suggest that creation has this inherent pattern of divine, of how the one becomes three and then seven. And that principle, that model, is repeated on different dimensions of existence. So you might have a 1-3-7 in a supernal level, in a divine world. And then you might have a 1-3-7 in a spiritual world. And you might have a 1-3-7 in a psychical world. And then you might have a 1-3-7 in the physical world. So that each of these worlds might be based on the same principles of design. One of the most profound esoteric symbols or glyphs is the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, which is a pattern of 10 spheres set on three pillars. And the top sphere is called Keter, or crown, and the bottommost sphere is called Malkuth, and Malkuth is the world made. So it's the Malkuth, the bottom sphere on the Tree of Life, represents the world made manifest. That is the world made. In Kabbalah, it's said that there are four world orders. And this is a very important concept, that there is a divine level of existence. There is a spiritual, a psychical, and a physical. There are four interpenetrating world orders. And we have different bodies or vehicles within different dimensions. Now, if you look at the Tree of Life, the Tree of Life itself embodies these principles of the one, the three, and the seven. Firstly, you can take the Tree of Life as a whole, and you might count it as a one. It is a symbol. It is a glyph. So in a way, it has a wholeness and unity to it. So it's a one. And then if you go into it and divide it, you consider first the top three spheres represent what are called the supernals. The supernals are like the root principles of creation. They exist before creation occurs. They exist all the time that creation is made manifest. And they exist even when the created universe dissolves again into non-being. So the supernals are the supernal principles, which are infinite, rather than finite. And they're the levels of primordial existence that make manifest a physical world. They are all appear in what is sometimes said in Kabbalah, that they are represented by the numbers 0, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 0. Because in a way, those three realms of Ein, Ein Sof, and Ein Sof Hour represent these eternal underlying principles. Ein represents a nothingness that's just unspeakable beyond words. Ein Sof represents the plenum, the abundance of things. And that's related to the ethers of space. And then the Ein Sof Hour is the infinite light, and that represents the spiritual principle. So you have the nothingness, and then you have the masculine and feminine principles, the principles of spirit and matter. So it's through the conjunction of the three supernals that creation issues. And creation is said to appear at first point, to have a first point of unfoldment, a zero point center. And then the bottom part, half of the Tree of Life, has seven sephira. So what you have is the three supernals and the seven below. And the seven worlds below are said to be inherent within Bina. Bina is the head of the feminine pillar. So Bina within herself, like Bina represents space and hyperspace, essentially. and these levels of existence, these seven worlds, are said to be latent in Bana, and when the spiritual chakma, the masculine principle, acts upon Bana, you have made manifest these seven different worlds created below. So in Kabbalah, what you have is this pattern of 1, 3, 7. And the Tree of Life is said to be a model of the nature of existence. So it's said to contain this secret knowledge about existence. It's said to be a model of the macrocosm or of the microcosm. And its effects are multiplied on different dimensions. So you can have four worlds, each of which might even have four trees of life within that world. Like the patterns are replicated on different levels in a fractal way. So you find this teaching of the 1, the 3, and the 7. Firstly, I uncovered it in the Gurdjieff teaching, and then the study of Kabbalah, and then the study of Blavatsky. And the laws of 3 and 7 are throughout Blavatsky's writings. She says at one point, 7 is the number of the divine mysteries. And she talks about how the triad of Kabbalah hangs the other 7. They're created out of the supernal triad. Now, if we go to Vedic teachings of India, they postulate like an ultimate life source, Parabrahman, and then when creation is made manifest, there are three modes of nature called sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva implies intelligence or information, mind. Rajas implies energy, force. Tamas represents matter and material nature. So whereas modern science, they talk about the duality of matter and energy, from a mystical perspective, again, there's really a triunity of intelligence, energy, and matter. And that there is an intelligence force that underlies and sustains all things. And this concept is now emerging in modern physics, and they say that we have been blind to the role of information. And many things in nature now are regarded as computers and as processing information. Even a particle, in a way, can be regarded as a quantum computer. What does it compute? It computes the laws of nature. So things in nature can be regarded as processing information and existing within information levels, which exists within space. So in mystical teachings, in the Vedas, you have a triunity of intelligence, energy, and matter. And when the world is created, it is said that it creates seven dimensions of existence, and that a human being has seven chakras or energy centers related to these seven levels of this hierarchical structure. So in the human being, it is said that the divine spark or the spiritual spark is brought down and is embodied within the heart in the sphere Tephra, which is central to the pillar, and it's directly below the three supernals. It's the only sphere below that has a direct link to the three supernals. So the three supernals come down and are established in Tiferet, in the heart chakra, at the center of the Tree of Life. Now, in the Kabbalistic teachings, below Tiferet, you have Yesod, Tefereth is the heart chakra, is also associated with the sun. And below Tefereth, on the central column, you have Yesod, which is represented by the moon. And that is said to relate to the psychical realm, the soul world. And then the final sphere on the center column is Malkuth, which is the world made. So, in a way, the tree of life represents these levels of consciousness. And similarly, in the Vedas, the whole concept of the seven chakras, which are connected by three channels called the Ida, Pingala, and Sushumna. And these three channels connect the seven chakras. So according to that perspective, there is this inner circulation of light within the human being that follows somehow the dynamic of the one divided by three and yielding seven. So we try to take that as a model of how things might work. So one of the things I've studied through the past years is trying to understand these kind of metaphysical principles and how they apply to things in life. And you can apply these concepts in any area of science. And it gives you an alternative perspective. Most importantly, it gives you a different perspective on the multidimensional nature of existence. Because, see, it's a very important and interesting question. Is there something in the human being that survives physical death? Okay, is there something that's more permanent? Doesn't mean that it has to be eternal, but it persists, something that persists longer than the dissolution of the physical body. And the material scientist Asimov, he says, when I die, the I is lost forever too. And from a mystical perspective, the basic principle of mystical teachings is to know thyself. And the whole concept in mystical teachings is that there is some hidden nature to self that most people don't realize. And this is hidden from us, and this is like the ultimate mystery, is to know self. Gurdjieff stressed this above all other things. He said, you have to come to know self. And what is this self we have to come to know? And what I realized is that modern psychology and science has assumed what I call the head dogma, the viewpoint that the brain in the head produces human consciousness, whereas the mystical and esoteric teachings suggest that there truly is some form of singular I connected to the human heart. And this isn't a singular I. It's not an I made up of DNA, which is all these millions and billions of DNA strands. That's not a singular I. The mystics suggest there is some type of singular I within the heart, and that is what we do not know. And partly how that is described, it is described as self-illuminating, like the sun, that there's a spiritual element within us which is self-illuminating. And there's different words for it in different teachings. Kabbalists talk about sparks of holiness, all which were part of the original Adam. And when creation occurs, there's a spark of holiness within each person. And one aims to attain to the realization of that emanation or divine element within oneself in the highest world. But then below that, there's a spiritual world. And the spiritual phenomena and world is very different from the psychical world. The psychical world in Kabbalah is called the world of formation, and it's more analogous to the physical world and is the foundation of it in ways. But there's why a person can have psychical experiences, positive or negative, but not with that being spiritual. So there's the divine world, the spiritual world, the psychical world, and then the world made, which is the end product of all these other higher worlds, and it is what we are in the physical body. And the idea is there's this divine spark that somehow its splendor is hidden within ourselves, within our own body. And in mystical teachings, the truth is under our noses all the time. and under your nose is your heart. So the idea in mystical teachings is there's some type of higher dimensional, divine, or spiritual spark connected to the human heart. And that this is the source of some type of internal, supernal light. And it is because of the presence of this spiritual entity within ourselves that there's the light of consciousness, which is required to create the holographic experiences we have through our lives. Because in a sense, there is a whole higher dimensional metaphysics that underlies the phenomena of life. And in a way, this higher dimensional metaphysics has to do with the nature of the human heart and the mysteries of the human heart. In a sense, your heart, there is not simply a material thing, but there's a psychical heart, which you see when people gain other people's hearts and they manifest some of the psychical natures of those other people. And then there's a spiritual heart center. They don't transplant the spiritual heart center. They transplant the psychical heart. And then beyond the spiritual heart is the divine spark. So, in all these teachings, then, the concept is that there is a higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to the human heart, and that we, as beings, are not at all what we've been persuaded or come to believe or conditioned to believe. There's something far more mysterious about human beings. That somehow there is some living entity in us that can survive physical death or experience apart from the body or have other lives, encounter other beings in other dimensions, and so forth. And such concepts are really amazing in that it creates, you realize the whole epic dimension of a human life in such a perspective, and how our lives are periods where we can have different experiences and learn and progress through different lifetimes. And this is the concept of people like Blavatsky and Gurdjieff, that we can acquire our souls in a way and live through different lifetimes and further our evolution in this grand kind of cosmic scheme of evolution. So mystical teachings offer a profound alternative perspective on essential ideas in modern science and psychology and physics and so on. And the Zero Point Show, you know, my friend Jim and I have kind of studied these things for 40 years together, beginning with our early studies of Gurdjieff and then studying Kabbalah and all kinds of other science and philosophy and so on. We try to bring it together. In a way, I think what the show offers is what is implied in the title of the fourth article I recently had published in the Esoteric Journal. And the title of that article was An Alternate Model of the Higher Dimensional Structure of Human Existence. And in a way, that's what we're trying to elaborate. And the aim isn't, it's not that it's like a dogma, because in this teaching, there's nothing you want to come to believe. In a way, it's not a system of belief. It's something you try to understand, and through that, to help you in your own awakening to understand these things. So it's not a dogma or a belief system, but it's a new way of trying to understand things. And the essential points in what we study, I can summarize very succinctly. Firstly, a human being's self-existence emerges out of the depths of the human heart. It is not a product of material processes occurring in the brain. Now, the self within the heart can then acts and interfaces with reality through the mind and the brain and the senses and the feelings and so on. But the brain does not produce human consciousness Instead, the consciousness emerges out of the heart, and there is a singular I connected to the heart. And Blavatsky describes this as a laya center, or a first point of supernal light, or some element beyond the level of our perception. If then we try to look at the universe in the same light, and modern views in physics about creation, again, they illustrate what is said in mystical teaching. Like the Blavatsky and the Kabbalist both stated 100 years before science came to this idea, they both stated that creation emerges out of realms of apparent nothingness and that there are first point sources of unfoldment. So Blavatsky and Kabbalah both have this notion of a point within the circle as symbolizing that first point, that singularity that emerges out of nothingness. And what we do in our studies is try to explain that there is a whole higher dimensional physics connected to the human heart, which has to do with this same dynamic. Kabbalists actually describe the heart as a vacated space, like there's this form of nothingness at the heart of being. And this is a very profound concept, the nothingness at the heart of being. And most people don't want to face the nothingness. They want to be something. And so we escape this nothingness. And in a way, this mystical path is to strip things away so you abide in that state, in experiencing that nothingness. Because in another sense, the nothingness is also the plenum, and it involves experiencing the abundance of things. So in mystical teachings, the gateway to higher consciousness and evolution is the awakening of the heart center, the heart chakra. And it's said that people asleep are controlled by the three lower chakras under below the heart. And you might imagine that as a downward turn triangle. And then you have a zero point center within the heart, and then you have three higher chakras which can be represented by an upward turn triangle. And if you bring these symbols together, what you have is a picture of a Star of David with the central point. And that in Blavatsky's teaching and in my own work is like the key image of trying to understand what I'm talking about. In a way, there is the patterns of the one, the three, and the seven. So we explored these subjects, the origin of consciousness connected to the heart, the idea of human beings as having a zero-point center, and then interstudying the study of metaphysics with modern science and science philosophy and physics. Okay, so actually I've talked a little bit longer than I have for a while. Jim, so I just kind of, I'm not sure what inspired me to try to give a talk a little bit about, well, give an overview of what we try to talk about in this show and again, to kind of summarize key concepts for people, because it is a very different kind of way of understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a very good overview, actually. I thought it was, you touched on a number of things, and it's like everything else. I mean, it's difficult because, I know what you're talking about, but I think you distilled a lot of things to the essence. It's funny because on different levels, different things strike me in different ways. It's like I thought it was very interesting when you said at the beginning, and because this really resonated with my own feelings, and sort of at times when I'm writing about this material, I have to kind of remind myself to put myself way back when before I got into any of this and started to assume this very different perspective. But at the beginning, you talked about when you first encountered the ideas of the laws of three and seven and how peculiar it seemed. And you know, we were both psychology graduate students at the time, and there's absolutely nothing in modern psychology or modern science or modern thought about the idea of universal cosmic laws and the idea that it's an alien idea to the modern intelligence, because it it just isn't something that people would recognize. And as you say, like, for me, I found it very, very difficult to even sort of try to apply that or have a grasp of that. But I do remember that with the Law of Three, just to backtrack a little bit, because the rest of so much of Gurdjieff's psychological teaching was, I thought, was very sophisticated and was really, really opened my eyes and awakened me to so many things, I was sort of willing to suspend my judgment about the Law of Three and the Law of Seven. And I remember that when we were beginning to work in this material, and you had developed, you were talking about the Law of Three, and you started to point out how this, what Gurdjieff said was true in scientific thinking is that you have, there's a lot of what he calls formatory thinking, thinking in twos, thinking dualistically, it's so ingrained in modern thought that nobody ever comments on it or notices it. It's always like people, when they're trying to conceptualize things, they seize on some essential feature or element or distinctive aspect of something, and then they think about what its opposite might be, and then they think that they've kind of come to a whole understanding of something. And Gurdjieff says that that in our normal waking consciousness, we are third force blind, that there always exists a third force in things. Sometimes it's in the medium itself of something that something is manifesting in, but often it's hidden, but it's there, and it plays a very important part, but people don't think about it. And one of the things he says about formatory thinking, which he means the most automatic and unconscious and rote type of thinking, he says that they're often telltale phrases, and such as nothing but or nothing more than, and you see that a lot, I think, in scientific materialist thinking, that they're always trying to reduce everything to nothing but material processes, and saying, well, that anything that's inexplicable is nothing more than or nothing but, and then they have some sort of pat explanation. So when you began to sort of conceptualize this idea that there were all of these unconscious dualities and dichotomous conceptualizations in modern scientific and psychological thought, that was the first example for me where I really began to see, oh, yeah, okay, like now I see this is an application of the Law of Three. And it just so happened that at the time that this was, that we were thinking about this and beginning to try to understand this, that the idea of the left brain, right brain, so-called lateral hemisphere, what is that term? I'm forgetting the term, but...
Well, kind of dual hemispheric
lateralization, like that, yeah. The right brain, left brain, was all the rage, and everybody was running around busily trying to put every conceivable human attribute and function into one hemisphere, and then its putative opposite into the other hemisphere. And what became apparent to anybody armed with this or approaching things with this idea of the Law of Three is how automatic and how formatory this thinking was, is that it's not to deny that there's such a thing as the left brain, right brain doesn't exist. That's not the point. Certainly, there are specializations of the different hemispheres, and they are distinct. But people are grossly oversimplifying and trying to reduce everything. Like people had the heart and artistic inspiration and night and you know, everything was being put in one hemisphere, and then, as they say, its opposite was supposedly in the other hemisphere. And this is completely ludicrous. And so that was the very first thing. I was like, whoa, this is a way that you can actually think in terms of numbers. And then, as you went on to talk about, in terms of universal processes, you see the Law of Three is repeated in various religious and esoteric traditions, whether it's the three gunas in Hinduism, or the three zazahat or hidden splendors in Kabbalah, or the Christian Trinity. They're all representing the Law of Three. And now, we find in modern physics, the most recent development, and is this idea that rather than just matter and energy, we have to think of matter, energy, and information. And this is an example, I would say, is where mystical and esoteric teachings would have anticipated and predicted something that modern science has come to understand. So
exactly. So you would have been led to that prediction.
Yeah, So that's a very striking example to me. I mean, it's something very fundamental. We're talking about the structure of the and nature of the universe. It's something very fundamental, which applies on all these different levels in terms of existence. Is something, you know, it's something quite striking. I mean, it's really has taken modern physics 100 years to come to this. More than 100 years to this viewpoint, but it's always been inherent in the mystical and esoteric traditions. I just want to point out something too that while I think of it, you were mentioning that this idea of the singularity or the point source at the center of existence is, and as the origins and natures of existence coming out of this singularity. And you were talking about Blavatsky was saying this 100 years ago in Kabbalah. Well, Kabbalah was saying it 700 years ago, and Blavatsky was drawing on Tibetan sources that may well be thousands of years old. So this idea has been within the mystical and esoteric tradition for at least hundreds and probably thousands and thousands of years. And again, this is another example of where mystical and esoteric teachings are clearly had an understanding well in advance of modern science of something very fundamental, like what was the nature of the universe before or at the point of the Big Bang.
It's like we can have direct experiences of the root principles in the
sense. Yeah. Well,
and that mystic in elevated states kind of apprehend some of that.
Well, that's the big question, too, is that, you know, and it's funny because I was thinking this exact thing again last night. I was trying to reduce things to first principles and trying to sort of recall and trying to extrapolate what exactly is the difference between the esoteric tradition and modern science. And this is the great question arises, is, okay, we've through modern science and through modern scientific thinking, we've come to these observations and these interpretations of the structure of reality. Well, what was it that these people thousands of years ago, who were clearly approaching things from a different perspective, how did they come to this understanding? And it's in the idea that in elevated states of consciousness and transcendent states of consciousness, people can experience these things directly and have profound knowledge of these higher dimensions. Not only do they have knowledge that in some way is paralleled or has been approached in modern science, but in the example of, for instance, the articulation of the higher dimensional dynamics structures that Blavatsky puts forth, you have a description of these higher realms, which are beyond that which is modern materialist science recognizes. So you have something even more fundamental where people have realized something and have been able to extrapolate from it and to describe these higher dimensional dimensional dynamics and higher dimensional structures that are basic principles of the universe, such as the discussion in Blavatsky of Fohat as the cosmic electricity which underlies everything. There's nothing really in modern science that parallels that explanation, although I guess at one point the idea of the ether is probably the closest that science has come to it. So
science doesn't see living beings as having a dynamic zero-point center. Like, even if scientists think that the universe emerged out of the singularity, they don't think that singularity is still there. They kind of think that it began with the singularity, and if it expands within without from a zero point, and then if the universe ever contracts, it'll contract from without within, and they conceive that it could, you know, at the end have what they call the big crunch.
Yeah.
Which is where it all crunches down into black holes and ultimately to an end point singularity. So those are the alpha and omega points of modern science. is this first point of singularity and the ultimate dreaded singularity. But they don't think that there might be a zero point center, or that singularity might be constant through the life of that universe.
Yeah.
Which is a profoundly alternative way of conceiving what that means, kind of. Because it's like there's that foundational point is there the whole duration. It's like the eternal principle within the finite or the temporal life. So the scientists don't conceive, they don't have that concept, from what I've, at least I'm familiar with, of beings having a zero-point center. Like, they don't imagine, they imagine the universe emerging out from a point, but I don't know of any psychologist or philosopher or New Age thinker kind of postulating that a human being has a first-point center connected to the physics of the heart. Like, I don't see anyone articulating that perspective. And it makes so much sense in a way, because it's like the Bible says, you know, God is, man is said to be made in the image of God. So if we think of, well, these are supposed to be principles of mystical creation, that the one, from the one emerges, is divided the three, divided by three and yields seven. So if that applies to the macrocosm, then it makes such sense to apply it to the microcosm, a human being. And then it all fits so perfectly with the yogic teachings of the chakras and the heart chakra. And even the yogic image of the heart chakra is the Star of David with the central point. It all just kind of ties in together so beautifully. And it ties in, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, how the Dalai Lama says within the heart you have a permanent atom. And the life kind of emerges from the heart through the channels and the chakra system, and then all through the body through different channels. So it all makes such sense as a scientific perspective. That doesn't prove it to be true, but what one realizes is like, wow, this is a whole alternative way of thinking about things that is intelligible and makes sense of many things that are otherwise inexplicable. Like, I remember for me, one of the early insights I had in terms of the consciousness studies was this kind of view in modern psychology that all our awareness of ourself is up in our heads. And when I started to try to be conscious of myself in myself, which one tries to do when you study the Gurdjieff teaching, you start trying to be aware of your own consciousness and be aware of it, cultivate awareness of it and what it is and where it seems to be. And you know, you do that from an inner perspective. And then over time, like, it's totally absurd and foolish to me to think that consciousness is only up in your head, because that's totally inconsistent with how I experience myself. Like, I know, you know, I use this illustration. If I put my attention into my left hand, when I do that, what happens is the blood flows to my left hand, and my left hand becomes engorged with blood. So what it seems to me is that my consciousness in my body is connected to blood flow, and I can experience that all directly. And it seems to me that my consciousness can be all through myself, because I can feel myself from the toes to the tip of my head simultaneously. Like, you can cultivate that, and it's like you can feel the blood flow all through yourself. You can cultivate that awareness within oneself. And then the more you do that, it's like this idea that our consciousness and mind is only up in our head, it's like it's absurd. It's the product of people who are intellectually centered, who try to understand consciousness with the mind. And so because of their tool or their method of investigation, they end up confusing the consciousness with their own minding. And they're thinking about things and analyzing things, and those things do go on in the head, because that's what the head is for, is like thinking and analyzing in that way. But then they make the mistake of then thinking that that is their famous consciousness. And yeah, so that's, I think in terms of consciousness studies, just realizing within my own experience that the idea of consciousness simply being in the head is like patently absurd. And so then you have to look what other dynamics might work. And when you, even when you look at a human being from a physical point of view, you realize, as Pearsall says, that the electromagnetic volume of the heart is 5,000 times greater than that of the mind in the head. So you realize that if you keep your concepts in touch with reality, then you might consider that the heart is a major center of our electrodynamic energizement, how we're kind of, that there's some life force. That's what mystics are saying. They're saying there's not only a self-luminous element within the heart, but that this has energetic nature, and it brings life into the heart. It generates the heartbeat, and it ensouls the body through the breath and through the blood, so that we are ensouled as beings. And the development of the mind in the head is something that comes much later. Like, there's consciousness within an infant before he's developed the faculties of the mind at all. It's not dependent on cortical activity for an infant to be conscious. It's something much more primary in a person's self-experience. And one can experience that directly. So it's like the mystics have had these profound insights into, like, creation and ideas about the universe, the multidimensional universe. They've had glimpses of these things in their own states. And even their own writings, they can't formulate it all completely and so on, you know. It's like one tries to bridge the gap between inner experience and what one would write or articulate, but that's not an easy thing, you know, because these are things that we don't have the words for, and we have so much false understanding about ourselves that it obstructs our realization of these things. I'm going to have to let my cat in the window here, Jared. So you're going to have to carry this. He's scratching away there. He sounds desperate. I think he has me under stimulus response control. Oh, but see, there's one of those dualities. We're talking about the dualities in science, and people just don't see how pervasive these are. And it's like stimulus-response psychology was the basic behavioral paradigm, that first you have a stimulus and it leads to a response. And it's really so simplistic and inappropriate, because you have no stimulus without a response, and there has to be an organism. It's really moving triads.
Right.
Or it's like the Hegelian dialectic, and people think there's a thesis and the antithesis, but then there's a reconciling force, which is the new synthesis.
Yeah.
And Hegel really didn't mean to, like, everybody talks about the Hegelian dialectic, like the Hegelian opposites, but they don't realize Hegel was really articulating the moving triads. But
yeah.
But we take it in a dualistic way, like we think of what he was saying. And you know, in science, it's cause-effect. There's, like, how profound scientific thinking is kind of linear. Like, you think there's a cause and an effect, and that effect can become a cause for a subsequent effect, and you think everything is linear, cause and effects. But really, it works as a mental model to a limited extent, and it's helpful, but really there are moving triads. And so this concept of how the scientists of new formation and modern New Age thinking and so much of science and psychology is always dualistic, whereas the mystics articulate these, you know, very profound principles of 3 and 7. So I got off, I guess, talking about consciousness again and then coming back to... where are we now? Any further thoughts, Jim? Oh,
well,
I'm going to go let my cat in. Hold, you can carry the show for a minute.
Well, I have a cat, too, sitting right beside me. I was just in response to the idea of the dualities that exist within modern thought and within unconscious dualities, I would say too, so much of modern science and psychology. Christopher was talking about stimulus response, and during the advent of behaviorism in the 1920s as the primary school of thought in modern psychology, for the longest time there was this argument that really everything could be explained. There was no need to even talk about the person, any interior dimension with people, because people were conceived of as being a black boxes, that there was a stimulus and a response, and nothing really happened in between. It was all mechanistic. And then eventually people realized, well, that's utterly absurd, that everything, every stimulus and response is mediated by what goes on within an individual. And so that very simplistic duality was surrendered to a threefold perspective, and that's a good example of the hidden third force within something. It's not that hidden in that case, but that is a good example of how thinking in twos is very formatory, is very mechanical thinking. Christopher talked about the idea of man being born and being made in God's image in the Bible, and throughout the esoteric and mystical literature, this idea is repeated in various axioms: as above, so below. Man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, and this is within almost every esoteric and mystical tradition. People talk about this, and that's the most basic point that I think that's something that it's very difficult to grasp how profound that axiom really is, because the idea that somehow laws that are applicable on a cosmic level can somehow be applicable on a human level seems, at first blush, it just seems completely absurd. And yet this is an application of how you can apply both the law of three and the law of seven on both a cosmic and an individual level, and you begin to see that yes, okay, you can conceptualize things that on a cosmic level in terms of the law of three, and you can, and the same with the law of seven, and you can also apply it on the individual level of a human being. And as Christopher was saying, you have in the yoga teachings are a good example of the seven chakras, and the ideas of that's the seven centers of energy in the human body. But also there's the three channels, the Ada, Pingala, and the Shushumna are the three channels for prana, which is the essential life energy which enters the organism. So you have this idea that you have a higher dimensional energy which is stepped down, like so a one becomes three through the three channels, is distributed through the body and the seven chakras. In Gurdjieff's system, you have something similar in the sense that he talks about human beings as seven brain beings. And he says there are seven distinct centers of intelligence in a human being, seven centers of consciousness, and there are five lower centers and two higher centers. And at times, most frequently, Gurdjieff talks about man as a three-brain being. And what he means by that is that there's an intellectual center, there's an emotional center, and then there are three other lower centers which work so closely together that he just characterizes them as essentially one physical center. But technically, there's a physical center, a moving instinctual center, a sexual center. But for purposes of conceptualizing human beings as three brain beings, he says there's man operates intellectually, emotionally, and physically.
And it's interesting, Jim, how the model also is that we have three bodies. Like we have a physical body, an astral body, and then a spiritual body.
Well, actually, I mean, he actually talks at times about the four bodies, because he talks
yes.
the mental and the causal bodies, is the astral, the physical, astral, mental, and causal body. But again, I don't know if you've caught the part I was talking about the yogic teachings, Chris, and about the three
channels. Yeah, I caught almost everything.
Okay, the three channels. But this is, again, like as I say, this is the difficulty of taking something like this idea, this axiom that man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, or as above, so below. And it's very, you can read that little phrase any way you want. You can read it superficially, it's completely absurd. But then, as you study it, if you try to understand it, I mean, I think we would both say that after 40 years, we have a very different understanding of those phrases from what we understood 15 or 20 years ago, or 25 or 35 years ago. It's very profound what's implied in there. In Gurdjieff's teaching, one of the ways he approaches is that, and this was always something, again, this struck me as being, at the beginning, when I was introduced to his teaching, I don't know if you hear that. I got a.
You're a cat.
He's got a cat. Another cat talking. I got a lot of cats. Anyway, he says at the beginning that when he's introducing his teaching that the division between psychology and cosmology is fundamentally it's an artifact. It's not real, because psychology is implied in cosmology, and cosmology is implied in psychology, and that's just another way of saying that man is the microcosm of the macrocosm. And for the longest time, I thought, well, I don't get that at all. But then, as you realize that these laws are applicable on different levels of scale, so that the universal laws are applicable on the on the level of a human being, then you begin to see why he says that psychology is implied in cosmology and cosmology is implied in psychology, because these are the laws parallel one another.
Yeah.
And there's an isomorphism between the bodies of the human being and the structure of the different levels, dimensions of the universal reality. So it's a very, very profound model of the nature of existence, which is quite at odds with everything that we assume in modern science and psychology. I wanted to come back just thought of this, because when in your opening remarks, I was really struck by this. And this is something that's taken me kind of years to even sort of recognize. But you were talking about Asimov saying that, you know, when he dies, that and all of the cells in his body stop having the life force in them, and you know, everything.
The eye disappears forever too, he said.
Yeah, the eye, and I realized, like, it's so weird, because I studied psychology, and as a graduate student of psychology, and I studied every major theory of personality, and I taught theories of personality, and I realized nobody really talks about what the nature of I is in a human being.
No, they don't.
It's so peculiar. Like, I mean, it took me years to kind of realize. I realized that one day, and I realized, you know, like, people really don't have any idea about I. It's like sort of the most basic fundamental. Well, they don't have any idea about consciousness either, which is also sort of fundamental, but it's so peculiar that there's no real discussion of what it is the nature of I.
And related to that, Jim, is how everybody assumes that it is there, because they say I.
Yeah.
Like, it's like one of the fundamental things that people take or know or feel intuitively, that there's a central I. Even for Asimov to say there's no central I implies kind of that there was a central I that thought there was no central I somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because the very fact, like, people have some sense of there's something in them. Like, I feel in a way that I'm the same. There's something in me now that was the same. If I look back and see myself as a young boy, and I can think there was something continuous that's been there through all that time. And my body may change, and my thoughts and understanding and things, but there's something that's continuous in terms of my being self-existence that is continuous throughout that.
Yeah.
So that's people's intuitive feeling, that I think arises from self-reflection and self-awareness. You realize you can't get a handle on what it is, kind of, but that is an intuitive kind of human experience, that there's some I that we refer to when we say I. Even though, as Gurdjieff explains, he says, we only know the multitude of little I's. We don't know real I, and that we have to attain to the awareness of real I. But that still makes sense, because that real I pervades all the little I's. So when you say I, it kind of implies that real I, even if people don't quite grasp that or experience it directly.
Well, again, that's very interesting, because it's like the dynamics are very tricky, in a sense that we identify with the false ego and we create this false sense of I. It happens. It happens automatically. Like in our lower level of consciousness, we have this identification with the wrong I, and we're not really, there is no real enduring I. It's all that, as you say, it's all these little I's. But the other side of it is that there's something, there is something which is more essential, which is not readily accessible, and which we don't know in ourselves,
yeah,
because it's only really knowable by a more perfected and unified conscious state that is enduring and is this, in Blavatsky's terms, like this monadic essence, like a spiritual spark, or
yeah,
this higher dimensional I does exist. It's like the somebody like Dennett would say, like, you know, he's I think the philosophical school, that this is complete completely grandiose on their part, they call themselves eliminative materialists, and they would say, well, the I, there's no I, it's just a construction, it's a social construction. It's like, you
yeah,
know, it's related to your identity and to the continuity of the physical body, but there's no real I. And
or someone like Wittgenstein, the philosopher,
yeah,
would say it's a category mistake, it's a mistake in language.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
a language that creates the idea of an I, so then people think they have an I.
And to a certain extent, that's
category
true.
Category mistake.
Yeah, to a certain extent, that's true. I think that there is something to that, but
I do too.
It's more complicated than, it's like in the Susan Blackmore, the British psychologist who did that book Conversations on Consciousness, and she claims that she says she's a Buddhist, and she says that there's no, her belief is that there's no enduring self, and then she says, I myself don't believe that there's any kind of enduring self. I'm like, well, wait a minute.
Don't worry, the thought will pass.
yeah, it's like, yeah, and within Buddhism, of course, like, that's true, but there is something more enduring, something more essential. So it's kind of like the problem,
yeah,
is that people
itself
don't recognize these things exist on different levels. That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's like the people think it's all just on one level, but that's where the idea. That's a perfect example of kind of like the hidden. It's not a formatory question. It's not, is there or isn't there an I? It's the hidden third force there is that it depends on what level you're talking about, because on the, you know, on a one level, there really isn't any enduring I, but on another level, there is, but we don't know it because it's hidden from us, and that's where it gets so incredibly tricky. But back to the original point.
No, but just to stick with that for a minute, like, see, I would say, yeah, but the jiva atma is there the whole time, under our noses the whole time, invigorating our heart and bringing life into us. It's there all the time. It's just the awareness of that at a spiritual level is beyond the level of our conscious realization.
Yes.
So, but it is there the whole
yeah,
time. It's like how I believe that there's a bliss sheath in the heart, that this
yeah, there wouldn't be any
zero
without
source
it
is housed in something that yogis call the bliss sheath. And that if your consciousness abides in that bliss sheath, in a way you feel filled with bliss and illumination of the self within the heart. So I believe that in ways that infants are still, their consciousness is still in that bliss sheath more, and it's only later that their ego develops and they lose more and more that awareness of that self. So I think in a way we come out of that state, so we do have deep remembrance of it, and then we get lost. So it's, yeah, as you say, it's like there is an I and there isn't an I. There is an I the whole time, but in our life, it we don't experience it. So it's like not there in our awareness. But it is there the whole time because it's the source of life and consciousness within ourselves the whole time.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly.
To get back to one other thing you had mentioned too, you know, the idea of the man is made in the image of God, and then as above, so below, and the microcosm and the macrocosm. To me, in a way, I think the most profound concept of what that parallel involves is this idea that things come out of nothingness and that there is a first point. And I don't, and then the further point is in this perspective, we're saying that element is then embodied through the principles of 3 and 7, and that those can be applied above and below. So the whole idea of man is made in the image of God has to do with this, like how we come out of nothingness, in a sense, the nothingness at the heart of being. And I just want to read this quote. This is from Papa Roach. From their song, it's called Between Angels and Insects. And it's like man falls in on that scale somewhere between angels above and insects below. But it says, tell them what you heard. It's about a revolution in your heart and in your mind. Because everything is nothing, and emptiness is in everything. This reality is just a fucked up dream with the flesh and the blood that you call your soul. See, he connects the flesh and blood to the soul. Flip it inside out, it's a big black hole. So, like, that's just, you know, a poet of the heart and soul, in a way, Papa Roach, in those lyrics. And he has, in a way, that's very profound mystical knowledge that he has in that verse. And there's a whole physics to it. It's funny, like this whole idea of there kind of nothingness at the heart of being. And the more we study the universe, we kind of realize its essential nature is nothingness somehow. And that we emerged out of that just like a universe does. I think these are all profound ideas about how to take that as above, so below. And I'm not sure I've seen other authors who kind of consider that type of perspective on those issues.
Well, yeah, I was going to mention that, too, is that I'm glad you brought that up again because you alluded to it earlier, but I think that's a real, as you say, I don't know of anybody, there may be somebody out there who is arguing that these principles apply, the zero-point origins of everything applies on both the level of the universe and the level of a human being, and I think you're the only person I know who makes that argument. So,
even though it's there in other teachings, like it's there in yogic teachings.
Yeah, you know,
in a way, what I think we've done more is try to draw these parallels and kind of synthesize these kind of wisdom teachings with a kind of scientific perspective and theory.
Yeah, because it's funny, too, because, I mean, that actually applies to the heart doctrine even, too, like, is that you know, it's quite amazing to me that when you began to write about the heart doctrine versus modern psychological idea of the head doctrine, that consciousness originates in the material processes of the brain and the head, and you argued that mystical and esoteric sources, you know, suggest that life and consciousness arise through the physical heart, which is rooted into these higher dimensions of the higher heart. And I, when you began to write about that and started sort of drawing more on more and more sources, I was quite shocked because it's odd that nobody else seems to have noticed this. I mean, I didn't know. But it's very peculiar once you're alerted to it. Like, I still come across things all the time. It's just, like, so evident that it's there. And that it's what's striking about it is that in so many different traditions and so many different paths and ways of knowing, people have come to the same essential idea, and this idea that there's some sort of very small, from a physical perspective, point source of life and consciousness, which is rooted in the heart. Like, it's there in so many different teachings. It's so peculiar that people don't, even people who are sympathetic to mystical and esoteric ideas, or people who articulate things in the New Age perspective, nobody seems to have cottoned on to this. It's very, very odd.
Very peculiar. I agree. Yeah. It's very peculiar.
And I mean, you know, like, usually if you're the only person who's saying something, you're probably because you're wrong. But, I mean, and, you know, in this case, it's not like you're the only person who seems to be taking this idea seriously and literally, but I mean, it's clearly, you know, I mean, it's like you're drawing on all these profound teachers throughout the ages, so it's not like something you made up, you know, one afternoon in your study or something. It's there in all of these teachings, and that's what I find so odd, is that people don't seem to recognize it.
Yeah, and you do see some people, like, it is coming in more, like you see the Heart Math Institute, for instance, and they're focused on the heart. And the energetic heart and the kind of health of the heart and such. So that's one group, but they don't deal with its deeper kind of mystical, metaphysical aspect. And then there's that psychologist I mentioned last week. I forget his name now. I didn't have time to search his work yet.
Oh, yeah. I remember,
But then you also look at Paul Pearsall and his book, The Heart's Code. And that was totally, when I read that, like, wow, here's one. I would say among modern theorists, his views are most similar to my own or to our own. Yeah. And he talks about, he connects the heart to the soul life. And he regards, he comes to this model of, like, a threefold nature of the man, and how he thinks we've been so mistaken, you know. So there are, you do find it places. But I was going to say also, going back to what you were saying when I started writing about this and showing this teaching in all different traditions, and I would say, in a way, I think it's a key. Like, I think if you want to understand esotericism and mysticism, there are certain things that are keys that unlock the mysteries of such teachings. And I think this teaching of the heart is one of those things that unlocks the mysteries, because once you hear it and begin to understand, you begin to see it in all these different sources, and whereas you hadn't kind of seen it before. In a way, you knew it, but you walked over it and around it and under it, kind of, but you didn't really. In a way, it's useful to have a label to put on it, like the heart doctrine, you know? It makes it more concrete. And I'm just going to read this quote from Blavatsky from The Voice of Silence. This is one of my favorite quotes. She says, "Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the eye from the heart doctrine. But even ignorance is better than head learning with no soul wisdom to illuminate and guide it." See, it makes such beautiful sense what she's saying. Like, head learning, like, there's a head learning, but then there's the soul wisdom, and the soul wisdom has to do with a kind of direct experience of the heart. And then head learning, and the soul wisdom, she says, to illuminate and guide the mind. So it's like, that's what mystical teachings, that there's this self-luminous self within the heart that illuminates the mind and allows us to be function mentally and be aware of our thoughts and so on. And then she says, and I think this is so profound, especially in this time of kind of epic lunacy on our planet, where we have the kind of Illuminati with their symbol of the all-seeing eye in the pyramid, which is on the American bill, of course. And this is like the symbol of the Illuminati with its illuminated eye, which Blavatsky would call the eye of dogma. And that's the kind of eye of mystical awakening. But Blavatsky, she writes, the doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. So she suggests that the heart doctrine is a higher or deeper teaching than is the doctrine of the eye. And I think this is really profound, because I think the madness of humankind and the kind of Illuminati, it's people who've actually developed psychical powers, awakening the third eye and acquiring psychical gifts and capacities. But I don't believe they're established in the heart. And it's like they bypass the heart. And so Blavatsky sees the doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. And I think, in a way, that's why I think, in terms of the situation of humankind on the planet, like, some people regard it, there's a spiritual war going on. And in a way, what I see it entails is these people who kind of adopt this Illuminati symbol of the all-seeing eye and kind of mental maniacs. And the struggle is between them and human beings who are upright of heart, whether you're Christian or Jews or Muslims or whatever, Sufis or whatever. So in a way, it's people, the struggle is between the doctrine of the eye and the doctrine of the heart. And I think the doctrine of the heart is really important to humankind, that we on our planet need to awaken in our heart and undergo remorse of conscience for the things that have happened and been done in our society and times. And we need to go through this process of awakening of the human heart, and people need courage to kind of face up and stand up and face the madness of our times. So I see the doctrine of the heart as profoundly important as a key to spiritual knowledge of self, at least for people to have this concept. And it can even be made practical. Like when I go about my life, sometimes when I self-remember, that means I try, which is what one learns in the Gurdjieff teaching, when you self-remember, you try to bring your awareness back to being here now, wherever you are, and kind of sensing yourself physically and being aware of what your emotional concerns and feelings are, and being aware of what's on your mind, and become aware of those things, but then to maintain your awakeness in the present moment. And you try to cultivate that. And you try to breathe when you do it, so you bring the breath into your body. And you can tap yourself on the heart to try to awaken a feeling in that part of your body, the sensation of the heart, because we want to cultivate awakeness in that feeling of the heart. So I think I think this is one of the missing keys to understanding esotericism, is this heart doctrine. And this is not to deny, like, the dimension of the eye doctrine. Like, I would say, like, if the person, it's like in the study of yoga, it is said that the first state is samadhi, then you become aware of the eye within the heart, and that establishes the basis upon which the illumination of self that can then illuminate the higher chakras. So you might acquire experience in higher dimensions or acquire higher spiritual powers of some type of knowledge or realization or gifts of the throat chakra would be a knowledge and speech and teaching. And the brow chakra might be to see into subtle dimensions and perceive things psychically. And the crown chakra is like being absorbed in kind of higher dimensional bliss states and realization. So there's these higher faculties that can be awakened. So there's validity to the eye doctrine in its domain. But really, it's like, it reminds me also in the Bible, it says, you know, what is, if you don't have love, what is life? I forget. It's like, you know that quote, Jim, where it says it's like a, there's some quote from the Bible that's so beautiful where it may, yeah, where, but it's like the empty, well, you don't sound, I forget the quote from the Bible. I wish I could remember that. But how in a way, a life with no love, in a way, you've not, you just pass away. You've not attained anything. You become as nothing. It's like the empty ringing of a bell or something like that. Or if you have not love, it says. What's wrong with the Illuminati? You know, they have these kind of, they're mental maniacs, kind of. This kind of, and acquire abilities in, at the level of what Blavatsky calls the astral light, like within the psychical world, but they don't attain anything spiritually, which is different than just psychical powers. It's being awakened in the heart. And that's what you see these people lack. Like, they think it's okay to have wars to make money, and you know, it's okay if you can make more money and you cause a depression and steal everything from people, you know. Or it's okay if you spread sickness and make more money through the pharmaceutical industries. You know, all these things are okay because, you know, we're elites and we go away and we have parties and have all kinds of enjoyments there. And we're elites, you know, and we're different. And, you know, there's something fundamentally lacking in these people. Like, we don't see nobility of heart among any of our world leaders. Or, I mean, there may be a few. I see some of that in Ron Paul. There's something in him that's different. But other than that, it's few and far between any of our leaders who have any nobility of heart. You know, it's amazing how people sell their souls in a way. I just see it makes such sense. You know, people sell their souls for money, sex, and power, and they don't have that love for humanity or love for other beings or love for the planet. And in a way, then they become as nothing. You know, it's like straw wind over, you know, blown away in the wind. The mystery of creation is like the mysteries of love and God's love, and love is something that holds it all together. It's a cosmic phenomena. It's related to gravity, you know. So, and it's said at the end of time, the Divine Mother, it's through love that the Divine Mother ingathers all the souls again to her bosom. It's like we emerge out of the heart of the Divine Mother, and eventually we're all absorbed back into it. So that's just a few of my comments on how I see this heart doctrine that's so profound to modern times and the kind of era we live in and the kind of delusion of the mind that's been perpetrated so much. People have to get back to knowing themselves within their heart and awaken that heart feeling. So then I guess I was trying to say about how I think certain concepts are like keys to understanding diverse mystical teachings. And I think, like, when you and I studied the Gurdjieff teaching, we studied the laws of 3 and 7, how for me that opened up all studies of Kabbalistic teachings and Vedas and Tibetan Buddhism. It opens up, you start seeing those principles, and it leads to your understanding that in a way these different teachings, they have different languages, but they're arriving at similar concepts. And that's really so profound that is so, which is not an explicable fact from the perspective of a modern scientist. Like, why do all the mystics come up with similar concepts in basic mystical teachings? And perhaps it's because it's real, because people experience these things directly. And it's not all just a matter of what theories we have up in our heads. That beyond that, there's some reality to what actually does exist. But anyway, I think we've been very lucky through our lives to, you know, have struggled to try to understand these issues, and they added a whole dimension to kind of understanding and experiencing life and looking at your life and trying to understand what is important.
Yeah, I just wish it paid better.
That's funny.
Yeah, well, you know,
that's so true, because in a way, I think both for us, ourselves, you know, we I know for myself, I mean, I've struggled through this with 40 years, and, you know, my study of esotericism like this is, in a way, created such hardship for me, you know, when I was a professor and then in corrections and just all through my life. It's been a, you know, it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't pay well.
There's no money in it, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny.
I mean, but, you know, it's like you have this kind of something that supersedes that as a motive. And I can understand the monks and people like that who can't give up. You know, like Christ says, you want to follow me, give up all your material possessions.
Right.
Well, in a way, I think we go through that inwardly in learning to not be attached to material things. And anyway, that does remind me, I want to mention, I do have that book special still on.
Oh, yeah, good,
I've discouraged how few of my books sell, I must say, through a month, because I do see them as such important books. Although complex, I hope at some point in the future I'll try to write a very simplified version where I just explain things without the language of anybody, but just most simply, you know, and write in a bit of a different format like that. Because my books are, like, quite academic, scholarly, scientific kinds of works. They're not light reads. They're heavy books, and, you know, they're books that you would reread over time and understand it more and more deeply over time. They're treasury books in a way because of that. Like, the Heart Doctrine has such a wealth of beautiful, mystical, spiritual writings of a diverse range of people that it's inspirational just as that, as a treasury of this kind of occult teachings. But anyway, I do have my five books, and I would sign them all, and including postage anywhere in North America. I'm asking $100. So that's kind of my book special. And you can see that up at the www.zeropoint.ca website. Okay, Jim, I kind of got aside from what we were talking about. It doesn't pay.
It doesn't. It doesn't pay. It's funny because I won $200 recently in a little short story contest at our work.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It was just I just wrote this stupid story, and it was fun. Like, it was just, you know, and we had a function at the firm that I work at, and everybody had to put a word down to describe either the firm or the day, and then the challenge was to use as many of the words as possible in the story. So I used them all, but I wrote this short story, and I won $200, which was the first prize, which was really nice. And I realized, you know, and several people come to me who read the story and said, "Boy, you're a really good writer." And I'm thinking, well, if you actually wrote the things that I write that really are important, you know, I mean, I'd like to be paid more than $200 for it, but it's like, there's, you know, it's kind of weird because you realize, like, you know, there's not much of a market for sort of the better work, you know. It's too difficult in a way for people,
Are you breaking up a little bit, Jim?
Oh, maybe I was moving away. Is that better?
Yeah.
Oh, I think I moved my head away from the phone. No, I just realized that, you know, priced in a way that your books don't sell better. But, I mean, that's not a comment on the quality, obviously, but it's just, it's hard to, well, I mean, part of it too is that you don't have like the marketing machine of a
no.
regular publisher who is going to
no.
draw attention and people are going to read about it in the Sunday New York Times or the, you know, the Globe and Mail's bestseller list or whatever. Like, and that is a big thing, you know. But, yeah, it's a bit interesting in a way. I mean, honestly, like the money, I'd actually like to be able to make a living doing this, and I'd like you to be able to make a better living doing this, but I don't really care about the money per se. I mean, it's easy to say that. I mean, I sort of do, but I don't. I mean, I'm willing to do other things to make a living, but because I kind of feel like I've been given this gift, and I can't imagine what my life would be without these ideas, and I just see how much more interesting it is, and I, as I say, I feel kind of blessed that I've been exposed to all this and had a chance to develop my own skills and my own work as a writer. Has meant everything to me, you know. For the longest time, I've been a writer since I was a kid, but I never really knew what I wanted to write about until I became interested in the Gurdjieff teaching, and then everything kind of came together for me. And I think it made me a much, much better writer because I took on something that was very difficult, and it took me forever to learn how to write about it, but that was okay, and that was sort of the price I had to pay for that. So it's like, you know, on the cosmic scale of things, it's like it's all good. But I wish these ideas were more widely known, just so people would know more about them. Like, you know, I wish they were out there for more people, so that more people could look at these things and try to examine them and try to develop them, because there's so many different ways these ideas can be developed, and there are people out there with skills that you and I don't have and knowledge that you and I don't have that would be fantastic. I'd love to be able to have this conversation with more and more people, and for just to challenge so much of what is clearly, like, there's a lot of nonsense out there and drivel. I mean, I think we always try to be mindful that we're not saying we're right about all these things. I don't think we could possibly be wrong about all these things, and it's not us, as we pointed out over and over again. It's like we're drawing on the great geniuses in the spiritual tradition, it's like, remember that quote from Newton, if I've seen farthest because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. You know, it's like, I mean, everybody builds on what comes before, and I mean, in our case, like, we're drawing on the great spiritual teachers of all time, and all of these people through the ages who have labored to develop these teachings and these systems, and I mean, it's quite fantastic. But it should, I guess, the main thing is that I wish these things were more known. And
especially, it's funny how they're not, because these perspectives are so critical to understanding the major enigma in modern psychology and science, which is what is the nature of human consciousness. And how possibly could these people have so ignored what's actually articulated in prime source materials? You know, that's shocking. So they're so relevant to that issue. And then the second issue they're so relevant to is creation physics. And the nature of reality and understanding issues about the ultimate nature of time and space and the nature of matter and energy, like all these fundamental issues and principles in science, that it's so invaluable to have a mystical occult perspective on these issues.
You know, today...
It only, I find, like, we get to feast on both worlds, because I can read anything in science and learn from it and you know, further my knowledge. But having a mystical perspective usually gives any kind of material a kind of deeper significance and an alternate perspective on that material.
You know, today you said something very interesting. It's a very interesting challenge, and I think it's something is something that probably you should do, that you, when you said about, you know, in your books, I mean, your books are very heavy and they're full of ideas and they're not easy going but at the same time, I mean, they're very stimulating, they're very engaging and very absorbing. But, you know, perhaps I'll give you I'll give you a challenge. I mean, I think you took a good step today in sort of doing what you were just saying, is that perhaps you should try to write a little book and just extrapolate from everything that you've learned. It's like, and I'll give you a title. It's like, you know, remember Erwin Schrodinger wrote that little book. Now I can't think of the title. What is Man? I think that's what it is.
Oh yeah.
Do you know the book I'm talking about? Where he got into, it's not just about physics. It's actually about a lot of
what is life.
What is life? Sorry, What is man? What is life? Yeah, thank you. And it's a really interesting little book. Well, I'll give you a title. What am I? You know, or who
oh,
am?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you try to write what you sort of did today, where you just sort of described the basic principles of an esoteric mystical perspective, and how they've, as a psychologist trained in the Western tradition, they've kind of given you an entirely different perspective, and one which is broader and more comprehensive, but addresses the very fundamental issues. What am I? You know,
yeah.
Who are we? You know, it's, I mean, it would be a very interesting, if you write it, I'll help you. You know, you write if you want to write the beginning, I'll go over it with you. But that's an interesting challenge to try to say, like, well, what have, you know, like, not a big book too, like 100-125 pages.
Yeah, yeah.
What exactly, you know, like the basic elements, like you've talked a lot today about the, you know, what you see as being fundamental to the esoteric, mystical, occult perspective. Maybe you should do that. Maybe you should try to write that. I mean, it's like basic issues about the nature of the I experience, the nature of life, the nature of consciousness.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly wouldn't. It's still not going to be as dumb as a lot of things, it's still going to be like, it's going to be difficult to a certain extent. But I mean, it's an interesting exercise to say, and I find more and more in trying to write about your work and in my own book, I find myself trying to think like more basically, like, well, so what's really different about this? Like, what is the essence of what's, you know, really different? Because it really is different from everything that exists out there. So, you know, that's an interesting exercise. I think you did a really good job at the beginning of the program today. I thought that was a very good presentation of some essential elements that really distinguish the mystical esoteric perspective from that which dominates modern science and psychology, and it's just so fundamentally different that the irony is that it's fundamentally different, but it's somehow, because it's a different interpretive framework, it's actually compatible with much of science. Like you say, you can read something in science, and it's not like you go, oh, this is wrong. It's like, it's the interpretation of it is perhaps incorrect, or is perhaps slanted in ways that ignore certain essential aspects that the mystical and esoteric perspective provide. But it's not like, you know, that you can't, I mean, it's not like you're overthrowing or going against science and modern thought. It's just that you're approaching it from, I'd say, a more comprehensive perspective.
Yeah, and it's funny because in a way, I suggest that this kind of interpretation and model of human existence and consciousness is really supported more thoroughly by the evidences. And by that, what I mean is, if you look at all the evidences for out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, psychokinesis, ESP, ghosts, poltergeists, all these kinds of phenomena for which there are massive evidences, and often by very serious scientists who were, you know, using the utmost of their own skills and analysis to explore these things, that really there's overwhelming evidence that in a way it all comes together, and like there's massive evidences for this. You know, we are not simply the material body. There is just so much evidence that's inconsistent with that perspective. You know, it's not just a dead universe with material beings living and dying with their bodies. There's something profoundly more deeper going on. And from my perspective, for people to ignore those issues, like, that's not scientific. That's what I would call quack science.
Yeah.
It's just having a materialistic perspective and insisting on it and just disregarding and dismissing all evidences that contradict it. And they themselves don't provide any possible adequate explanation of these profound mysteries, like what is consciousness, you know? So in a way, I see that much of the mainstream is the views of scientists against the mystical and metaphysical and occult and so on. I see that as a form of quack science and not embodying the best of the scientific method or rigor. Whereas they kind of think, oh, automatically, if you think there's a spirit or soul, then you're quack science. So they, in a way, have everything exactly reversed.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, exploring these issues is profoundly important because all human beings, we all have to realize, as Gurdjieff says, that we all do pass away. That, you know, Gurdjieff says, like human beings, they need a new organ implanted in them that would remind them of the inevitability of death. And then that kind of raises, is there something in me that can persist beyond death? And what is the purpose of life? Like, if your purpose of life is to acquire material wealth, I'm not sure that that serves you well in the moments of death because you're not kind of taking it with you. You know, many things that we put our energies into in the bigger scheme of things, they're not what is significant. I mean, when people have near-death experiences and they wake up to these other realities, they come back and they realize the importance of love. Okay? And that's one of the most important things. And they lose their fear of death. And you know, it has profoundly valuable impact on people. And a different perspective on life. And when you realize, if you grant validity to these kinds of experiences and evidences, it raises such profound questions then about, well, how can this all work? How could this be possible? And as true scientists, I think that's the attitude we need to take, is how can these things be possible? And to explore how that could be possible. And even if that means suspending your kind of belief or disbelief in it, but at least to think it out as an issue. No one even does that. It's just like this dogmatic refusal to consider the psychology of spirit and soul. It's just regarded as metaphysical or, you know, it's the stuff of poetry. But they don't realize, no, if it's true, then there has to be a profound science to this all. And we need to inquire into this. You know, this is part of our humankind's quest to know ourselves as what we are, as beings. So, you know, all these evidences that suggest there's something more to life, you know, everything from meaningful coincidences to, you know, all the coincidences of number studies and all the kinds of evidences suggesting there's something more than the kind of blind materialist, you know, four-dimensional space-time. You know, there's something deeper and more significant at work in this cosmos, and we're fools to simply assume a materialistic perspective on all of that and you know, maintain a superficial dismissal of these traditions and these teachings. It's very sad that it's come to that so much, I think, in modern education and science and psychology. We don't have a spiritual perspective. And I think partly what we do through our work is to bring these realms, these subject matters, into a scientific perspective while posing a challenge to modern science. Not that anybody ever responds to me or talks to my work. So, but at least, you know, in my own mind, I'm a legend in my own mind. Yeah. You know, my own mind, I've kind of provided an alternative way, as have do many others, you know. It's just part of a larger, because there are other people who consider these perspectives and research it and write about it, and you know, people contribute in so many ways. But in my view, there are certain keys which have been missed. One of the keys is the heart doctrine, the concept that the I experience originates out of the depths of the heart, and that's a profound concept. And the other is that there's an actual zero-point center. There's some higher-dimensional physics to the heart, and it involves zero-point fields and the quantum vacuum, whatever you want to call it, hyperspace, you know, higher dimensions. Like these are scientific ideas. They're ideas that can be formulated in scientific theory. And then the third thing, this idea of trying to understand these principles of creation, the laws of 3 and 7 that we find throughout the mystical literature. I think these areas particularly are just profoundly important. And then related to all of this is this idea of how we need in our lives to strive towards our own possible evolution. And I love that title of Uspensky's book on Gurdjieff's teaching, is The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. Because it's like on this planet today, we have such madness of humankind, the kind of madness Gurdjieff talks about, where he says if a man could see all the horror of the lives of ordinary people turning around in circles of insignificant interests and insignificant aims, he says, if they could realize all that they are missing, they would realize that the most important thing is to learn to be free. What is important in to a person in prison condemned to death is how to learn to be free. And the mystical perspective kind of introduces that into our lives. Is like, you know, we want to learn to be free. And I see being free as being free of negative emotions and free of all the conditioning of false conditioning that's been imposed on us, free of the false ego. And I think we're free in spirit. So it's and you know we all do know that we all do die. So what on our deathbed, or if we can envision, like after death and looking at our lives and saying, well, what did we do? You know, or what happened in us? Gurdjieff would say, yeah, everything happens, he says. Jeremy Uspensky says, everything happens from the moment you're born to the moment you die. Things happen, and you think you're doing. You kind of think you're pushing the current. Well, really, the whole time you're just swept along. So, you know, it's like Lenin says, life is what happens while we're making other plans. I love that quote. I'll give you a few minutes, Jim. We got like 5-7 minutes left. If you have it, it's been an interesting show today.
I got nothing. Yeah, no, it's been very interesting, as I say. It's a very interesting exercise to, as I say, to try to step back and look at this, because after a while you become involved in seeing things from a very different perspective, and you can see it, and you're busy trying to communicate it to other people in certain terms, but sometimes what gets lost in that whole process is just how radically different this is, and you have to try to understand, well, what essentially is different about this. And I think that, as I say today, I think the opening talk that you gave was a very good identification of certain critical elements. And I think you're right in saying that there are certain key elements that really do are the beginnings to understanding something in a fundamentally different way about the nature of ourselves and the nature of the universe and the nature of our relationship to the universe. It's a lifetime's work to understand this, because it always gets deeper. It always gets more complex and comprehensive. But there are certain critical elements, and I think even just, you know, for people just to even consider these ideas is a very useful exercise, because what it does is it undermines or at least challenges the conventional assumptions that people make about the most fundamental things like the nature of the I experience, the nature of life, the nature of consciousness, the nature of the universe, the origins of the universe. I mean, it's one thing that we can all say, well, the universe originated with the Big Bang, you know. Well, yeah, everybody can say that, but what exactly does that mean, you know? Or it's like, you know, I will perish with the death of my physical body. Well, what exactly do you mean by that, you know? Like, it's easy to say these things, or I will survive because I have a soul. What do you mean by that? Well, I believe in God. Well, what do you mean by that? Or I don't believe in God. I mean, the problem is that we're so identified with our perspectives and with our assumptions about things that we don't often question what we really know and what we don't know, and that's the most important thing in trying to really educate, that is in the sense of the term, the real sense of the term, to bring out that which is within. We don't distance ourselves from our assumptions what we think we know too often enough, and even when we do know things more fully, like, we have to step back from time to time. It's a good exercise. So and I really think you should try to write a little book and just explain things as after 40 years as a mystic scientist, what you've come to understand about, you know, how we could understand ourselves in a very different way. I think that would be a very good exercise for you.
Yeah, it would be. I will put that on my list of books. I know I have three others I want to complete. You know, I've got most of Microcosm, Macrocosm done in the
Zero Point
series, so I want to finish that.
That's important.
And I'm currently writing this God's Contracting Universe, which is my more political writings. So I have a few things I'd like to do before I come to that, but... You're right. It's an interesting project. So I would encourage people a visit on my website at www.zeropoint.ca, because I'm up in Canada. And I'd like to thank BBS Radio. It's been an honor. I can't believe all the valuable materials we've got up available through the BBS archive services. It's a wealth of mystical and materials we have up there. And we keep coming back to the same thing, Jim, but I think people who follow us, they develop more over time an understanding of it. It's not like these concepts you can hear once or twice and grasp them. It's like an understanding that evolves over time. And, you know, I think it's valuable when we try to come at the same ideas from different perspectives, and it fills it in a lot. Fills it in a lot. So we'll be back in 2 weeks, Jim. Let's pick up the slugs, Jim, and really do the psychopathology of man and the causes of war, according to Gurdjieff.
Okay.
And we will pursue that next time. We didn't come to it today, but I felt it was a good show, and thanks for being there, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. And if there are people out there who are listening to us and have questions, we certainly invite you to maybe next show open up the phone lines if somebody wants to call in with a question or a comment, you know. It doesn't have to be a question. Yeah, it'd be great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks all. Goodbye.
Thanks, BBS. Bye now.